books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood. And as the Wigtown Book Festival starts on the 26th of September, a week from the date this show is broadcast, I thought I'd have a listen back to some of the interviews conducted at Wigtown over the years. And as always, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
So coming up today, we'll get the books of my life from both Graeme McRae-Burnett and from Scotsman critic Stuart Kelly. We'll hear about the removal of some statues from Alex von Tunzelman. With Henry Mance, we'll learn how to love animals. We'll hear from the author of The Girl on the Train, Paula Hawkins. And up first, let's hear from Maggie O'Farrell. Maggie O'Farrell is the author of Hamnet, winner of the Women's Prize for Fiction 2020, and the memoir I Am, I Am, I Am, both Sunday Times number one bestsellers. Other novels include After You've Gone, My Lover's Lover, The Distance Between Us, The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, and The Hand That First Held Mine, which won the Costa in 2010. Maggie was at the Wigtown Book Festival to talk about her book The Marriage Portrait, a dazzling evocation of the Italian Renaissance in all its beauty and brutality. It's winter in 1561. Lucretia, Duchess of Ferrara, is taken on an unexpected visit to a country villa by her husband Alfonso. As they sit down to dinner, it occurs to her that her husband has a sinister purpose for bringing her here. He intends to kill her. What is Lucretia to do with this sudden knowledge? What chance does she have against Alfonso, ruler of a province and a trained soldier? The Marriage Portrait is a reimagining of the life of a young woman whose proximity to power places her in mortal danger. The audio version is read by Genevieve Gaunt.
A foreign dignitary arrived in Florence presenting the Grand Duke with a painting of a tiger. Cosimo was very taken with the gift, and it wasn't long before he expressed a desire to own one of these vicious, singular beasts. He kept a menagerie in the basement of his palazzo for the diversion of visitors, and he felt that a tiger would be an excellent addition to his collection. He gave an order to his consigliere ducale, Vitelli, that a tiger must be found, captured, and brought to Florence. Vitelli, who had foreseen such an outcome ever since the painting arrived at court, heaved a deep and private sigh, duly making a note in his ledger. He hoped that the Grand Duke might be persuaded against the plan, or even forget it, occupied as they were at that time by Republican unrest in Siena. Cosimo, however, refused to comply with Vitelli's secret hope. "What progress on the tiger?" he asked one day, without warning, as he stood on the terrace, readying himself to leave for his daily exercise, removing his lucco and strapping on his weapons. Vitelli, caught off guard, fumbled with the fastening of his ledger, and managed to mumble something about difficulties with certain nautical routes from the east. Cosimo was not fooled. He fixed Vitelli with his left eye, while his errant right eye looked off to the side, at a place just beyond where Vitelli stood.
It's based on the true story of a young Renaissance duchess who realises that her husband is about to kill her.
And what was the inspiration behind it?
Well, two things, actually. It was a poem and a painting. So I've always loved Robert Browning's most famous poem, My Last Duchess. And in it, it features a duke who pulls back a curtain, showing a visitor his paintings. And he says, "This is my previous wife, and by the way, I murdered her." So I thought that I've always loved the poem, and I thought I really wanted to write the story that she herself might have told it. I thought she's been behind that curtain for hundreds of years. It's time for her to have her say. So I looked online and I found a portrait of her. So she was called Lucrezia de' Medici, and she was 16 when she died. And Angelo Bronzino did a very beautiful painting of her when she was 15. And in it, she looks very anxious. She looks very worried. She looks as if she has something she wants to say. So it made me want to write her story.
She is walking in soft shoes and a flowing yellow dress. She has a pale blue cap on her head, on which the sun throws down gentle probing arrows. They land on her crown, her forehead, like the pats of a tame animal. She holds out a hand on either side of her, each palm brushing against the upper leaves of the box hedges that line the path. The sun finds her hands too, such a thorough, tireless sun this, making the skin prickle and seethe. Her footsteps are slow and measured. She can walk with every footstep pressing a print into gravel at her own pace, in any direction she chooses, for as long as she wishes. There is nobody here to bother or pester her or put her in danger. She can go where she pleases, Alfonso told her so, using these exact words, where she pleases. This thought effervesces inside her, bubbling up her throat to exit her mouth as a sound halfway between a laugh and a squeak. Around her, the garden stretches, impassive and incurious. She is alone, apart, that is, from a man with slightly bandy legs and a curved knife in his belt. Alfonso said this man would accompany her on her walks, always at a distance, and that she must not give him a second thought, and that if she wanted for anything, she could summon him and he would be at her side in seconds.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download your book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a small description of the cover?
The cover is an absolute beauty. It's up there with my favourite covers of mine. It is mostly green and it's a kind of jungly background and it's got a tiger leaping across it. So it's not exactly Renaissance art, but it's certainly very, I think anyway, it's very beautiful and it's very intriguing.
Now, the audio version is read by Genevieve Gaunt. Let me say this first. Given your reading at the start, have you never fancied narrating any of your own audiobooks?
I think I'd be really bad at it. When I was a child and a teenager, I had a really bad stammer. So actually, reading aloud and talking aloud, it's kind of difficult. I mean, I've had a lot of speech therapy for it, so I'm better than I used to be, but it's still problematic for me. So no, I'm more than happy to leave it up to professionals such as Genevieve.
As I said, Genevieve Gaunt narrates this, L. Potter narrated Hamlet. Do you have any say in the narrators of your books?
I do, actually. Yes, they're very nice. The people who record them often send sort of 4 or 5 samples of voices. And I thought Genevieve was very good because she's quite young. So she's obviously narrating the story of a 16-year-old. And I think I'm right in saying she's half Italian. So she does the Italian pronunciations, particularly with real panache.
Is it important to you that your books are available in accessible formats for people, for whatever reason, can't access print?
Absolutely. I mean, a story is a story. And I think, you know, if we go back to our very human origins, all stories were told orally. So I think it's a very important tradition for us.
He is a good man with a family to provide for. I chose him for the job myself. It would be a pity if he were to be punished for letting you leave alone, would it not? She allows there to be a pause. It grows between them there on the path. A dignified silence, one that tells him that she is a duchess, above behaviour as petty as his, that she is considering his suggestion and will let him know her answer in good time. She will not look at him while she maintains this stillness. She considers the path leading away from her, the way it draws the eye along the valley floor between fields and enclosures, through woodland narrowing and vanishing. She looks back at the villa, its gables glowing red, the windows reflecting repeating squares of clouds. Very well, she says finally, and she turns back the way she came. Leonello gives the bridle of the horse a sharp tug and walks along beside her. From their saddle gibbet, the hairs swing and sway.
The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell is available in print as an e-book and in audio as read by Genevieve Gaunt, both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Graham McRae Burnett is a highly acclaimed Scottish author. His first novel earned him the Scottish Book Trust New Writer Award in 2013. And his second novel, His Bloody Project, was shortlisted for the 2016 Booker Prize. I met him at the Wigtown Book Festival to discuss his fourth novel, Case Study. And while there, he told me the books of his life.
Rem, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There was a wonderful book. It was in my grandmother's house. It was called Mr. Papengay and the Little Round House. And it concerned a little boy who goes to post a letter, but then he finds himself inside the pillar box with this weird community of people. And it's a sort of real, it's actually totally Kafkaesque. It's like Kafka for kids. And I was totally, every time I went to my granny's house, I returned to this book and just started rereading it again. It's really magical.
Quickly, he turned his head back again and looked at the friendly pillar box. And then he gave a funny little gasp and all at once stood still and stared. A light was shining through the slit in the round red pillar box. Robin took a few slow steps forward and then stopped again and stared. The pillar box was still round and red, but it was no longer ordinary looking. Half a dozen little windows with lace curtains had appeared in its side, and low down by the pavement he could see a little front door with a knocker and a letterbox and a bell. The pillar box was no longer a pillar box. It was a little round house.
Mr. Papengay and the Little Round House, or as I found a copy of it simply titled Little Round House by Marion St. John Webb, is available commercially, read by Margaret Wooster. Although, like me, you may have to search for a while.
And is there a book that on a rainy day, like today, you go back to again and again?
The book I return to most is Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, simply because I've become familiar with it. I love the world of the book. And although it's out from the outside, it might seem like a big, heavy Russian classic, it's tremendously compelling. And the characters are, you're so full of life and the settings are so full of life. So that's a book I can go and I'm in the world of the book.
In early July, in exceptional heat, towards evening, a young man left the garret he was renting in Stolyarny Lane, stepped outside and slowly, as if in two minds, set off towards Kukushkin Bridge. He successfully avoided meeting his landlady on the stairs. His garret was right beneath the eaves of a tall, five-story building and resembled a cupboard more than it did a room. His landlady, a tenant herself, who also provided him with dinner and a maid, occupied separate rooms on the floor below, and every time he went down he had no choice but to pass her kitchen, the door of which was nearly always wide open. And every time he passed it, the young man experienced a sickening, craven sensation that made him wince with shame. He owed his landlady a small fortune, and he was scared of meeting her.
There are two versions of Crime and Punishment by Fyodor Dostoevsky in the RNIB library. One read by Corbett Woodall that is 23 hours and 50 minutes, and the one we've just played narrated by Don Warrington, which comes in at 25 hours and 3 minutes.
And is there something contemporary you'd like to recommend?
Reasonably contemporary. I really enjoyed Deborah Orr's memoir, Motherwell. I'm from Kilmarnock, a little bit younger than Deborah Orr was. But I found her writing about growing up in the 70s in a town a bit like mine just super, super familiar and very enjoyable, very compelling and quite moving.
We were wary of the Bureau, my brother and I, even though it was ours now and we could do what we liked with it. There was no one to stop us anymore. No mum, no dad, no rules. Yet so much of the Bureau had been a forbidden zone for such a long time. The administrative heart of our family home at number 18 Clyde Terrace Muir House, Motherwell ML12NG. My parents had bought the bureau when they first got married and set up home on Empress Avenue in Romford, Essex at the start of the 1960s. It had made the journey with them up to Thistle Street, Motherwell, Lanarkshire, less than a year later. That was where we lived when I was born. 4 more years, and it had travelled another couple of miles to Shields Drive, Muir House, Motherwell, and the birth of my younger brother David. Another 6 years, and another few hundred yards, and the bureau, along with its complete and perfect nuclear family, had reached Clyde Terrace, where it stayed for almost 5 decades, before it headed back the way it had come and moved in with me in London.
Motherwell, A Girlhood by Deborah Orr is narrated by Gabriel Quigley and is available commercially. And Graham McRae-Burnett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Always good to talk to you.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
We're listening back to some interviews I recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival over the years, as the festival starts a week from the date this show is broadcast. For tickets and events, just search for Wigtown Book Festival. Still to come, we've got Statues with Alex von Tunzelman. We'll hear from Paula Hawkins, Stuart Kelly, and in a moment, we'll be loving some animals.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
We all love animals, but does that make their lives happier? With factory farms, climate change and deforestation, this might be the worst time in history to be an animal. In his book and audiobook, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World, Henry Mance sets out on a personal quest to see if there's a fairer way to live alongside other species. The audio version is read by the author.
Why is it okay to keep pigs in barren enclosures, but not dogs? Why is it morally wrong to hunt a dozen whales, but not to use fishing nets that entangle hundreds of dolphins? Put simply, love for animals is one of Western society's core values, and rational thinking is another. But the way we treat animals doesn't fit with either of these values. It is guided by tradition and inertia. No one would vote for the looming mass extinction of wild animals, certainly not the animals themselves. Goodness knows how we will explain it to the next generation. But it is happening on our watch. Charles Darwin concluded that blushing was the most human of all expressions, which is lucky, as we have plenty to blush about.
A clip of How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World by Henry Mance and read by the author, who I met at the Wigtown Book Festival.
The book is trying to find an ethos by which we can live more happily with animals. At the moment, I think lots of people feel uncomfortable about where their meat comes from, and they know that the standards on some farms are not great. And also people are worried about whether wild animals are going to be there. You know, a million animals are threatened, a million species are threatened with extinction. And so it's trying to think of a way that I and my kids might be able to live in a more harmonious way with other species.
And you're grappling with some big questions around things like hunting.
Yeah, hunting, you don't really get much more controversial than that, because people see it as the way it was in maybe the 18th, 19th century, as a kind of complete domination of other species. And of course, we've moved beyond that, and we now see that other animals have emotions, they have social lives, so how could we be so callous as to go out and shoot them? And one of the kind of the counterintuitive conclusions I come to in the book, as someone who doesn't eat meat or dairy, I'm not really okay with a lot of livestock farming, is that hunting can be better than that. It can be ethical, it can be a way of preserving wild spaces, of giving those wild spaces a value, and also of playing the roles of predators that we've extinguished. Across Britain, just before the shooting season begins, about half of birds are pheasants and partridges. I mean, you're talking tens of millions, I mean, the exact figure isn't known, released to be shot. And I think that is not ethical hunting. That is a sort of pastime that doesn't really play into the natural world. And also, the welfare implications of breeding those birds in cages is not something that I would support. And so it's the ethical hunting, it's the hunting which looks to work with the grain of the land, that says we are living within ecosystems and relationships that I'm sort of interested in. Before coronavirus hit, optimists would often say that this was the best time ever to be a human, that if you could choose any time in history to be alive, it should be now. But what would other animals choose? If you were born as a non-human mammal today, there is a greater chance than ever before that you'll be born in a factory farm, in cramped, unnatural conditions. In a large dairy farm, a cow produces perhaps four times as much milk as she would have done a century ago, but her life expectancy has actually fallen. As a wild animal today, you would likely have a greater risk than your preceding generations that your habitat is being destroyed, or that the climate is changing to something you can't adapt to. Wild animal populations have fallen, two-thirds on average since 1970, according to the Living Planet Index. Because of the growth of animal trading, particularly in Asia, there's probably also as great a chance as ever that you would be taken from the wild and kept in cruel conditions. We might fancy the life of a dog in modern-day America, lazing on the sofa with organic biscuits and a whimsical Instagram account. But if we were randomly reincarnated, we'd be at least 20 times more likely to end up as American factory chickens. Given the choice of any time, would an animal choose to be born now? I don't think so.
Now, to the physics of the book, you read the audiobook yourself. How was that?
Oh my goodness. I mean, it doesn't... people don't realise how difficult it is. Certainly I didn't. And I spent hours with very kind, patient producers. And if you deviate one word, if you say which instead of that, there's someone listening in saying, uh-uh. So it was a real experience. But it gave me a chance really to reflect on the book, which I put together over months. And, you know, I realised how many people listen to books. And if that's bringing it to a wide audience, I always wanted to make sure this book, both in its tone, like it's not a miserable book, it has jokes, it's about my family, it has sort of hopefully nice anecdotes and statistics. So I really wanted to make sure that it was attractive to lots of people. And if being an audiobook is part of that too, and it is, then I'm so happy that it's out there in that way. What would happen if we thought about animals, all animals? Would we change the way we source our food, the way we treat the natural world, and the way we look at animals in zoos? Like many people, I fell in love with animals because I thought they were beautiful. My family had a pet dog, and my parents took me to zoos. We'd watch the Grand National on TV, and I'd feel baffled that jockeyless horses were disqualified. Wasn't it kind of interesting that they ran faster once the humans had fallen off? At university, I was briefly vegetarian for environmental reasons, until I clicked the wrong option on a drop-down menu and ended up on a long-haul flight, being served a meal of raw carrots. In my 20s, I took up photography. I became obsessed with capturing the speed of hummingbirds, the detail on grasshoppers, and other kinds of animal wonder. In the spirit of George Best, I spent 90% of my money on camera lenses. The rest, I just wasted. Animals make the best photographs. Half a dozen silver fish shimmering on the dock. A Bornean orangutan dangling nonchalantly between trees. A young hippo on a Colombian farm once owned by drugs lord Pablo Escobar, who, unlike me, did regard raw carrots as soul food. The closer you look at our fellow creatures, the more astonishing they become. On the boat back from one photography outing, watching puffins battling the North Sea wind to return to their nests, I overheard a small boy murmur earnestly to his parents, "I love the puffins." "I love the puffins too," I thought. But what had I actually done for them, besides taking photos? Had my admiration made them any better off? Had I repaid the pleasure that they had given me? I was an animal lover in theory, but perhaps not in practice.
What message do you want people to take away from the book?
That when you say you love animals, that's not enough to be an animal lover. That actually being an animal lover involves thinking about your behavior, thinking about your footprint on the natural world. And unfortunately, for too many years, you know, we haven't been thinking about the impact on farm animals. We haven't been thinking about how much of the Earth's surface we're taking up and what we're throwing into the environment. And yet there are very simple things you can do, like eating less meat, eating less dairy, not flying as much, reducing your carbon footprint, and also just calling for change, calling for national parks to be created, donating to organizations who do that. And those changes can make a huge difference in what wildlife is available to our children. And it can, I think, lead us to live happier lives because animals give us so much pleasure.
How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World. Written and read by Henry Mance, is available commercially now and in the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 or head to rniblibrary.com.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
A Rebel in Gaza, A Daughter of Rafa, speaks
by Asma Al Ghul, was donated by Faber and Faber.
When the First Intifada broke out in 1987, I was only 5, but I still have the smell of the tear gas in my nostrils. Hamas was founded in the same year. I grew up with it. It was a world that was both stable and sad. My uncles were members of Hamas. That's why the Israelis would come bursting in on us in the middle of the night, terrorizing me. However, I had been to Israel when I was little. Grandfather Joma, my father's father, worked in a hotel there, which had helped him get admitted to a hospital in Tel Aviv when he had heart problems. I was taken there to visit him. The bus stopped at a service station, and the pump attendant started to clean the windows by spraying them. The water came out of the pipe and splattered on the glass, making it look rippled. I was afraid and started to cry. At the hospital, I went up in an elevator for the first time in my life. When the door opened, the decor was completely different. I couldn't understand it. I asked my grandmother, "Have we been on a journey, Teta? Have we been on a journey in this... I didn't even know that it was called an elevator."
Born in Rafah, raised in Gaza, subjected both to Israeli bombs and to Islamist tyranny, and in the face of prison, death threats, abuse, misogyny, violence and repression, Asma Al Ghul has continued to speak her truth. She's continued to live, to love, to laugh and to protest. In this moving memoir of growing up Gaza with a hunger for freedom and a passionate attachment to the places she calls home, journalist, writer and activist Al Ghul recounts her lifelong resistance to religious fanaticism, state-sponsored violence, and all forms of repression and subjugation.
A little later, we were sitting on the hospital lawn, all that green around us. I couldn't believe my eyes. In the camp where I'd grown up, there was no greenery at all. My grandfather and I looked at the women stretched out on the grass, heads bare, together with their families. That one has cancer. That one has a heart condition. Over there, it's her children who've come to see her. In that garden, I discovered that the Jews were perfectly ordinary people. I still couldn't believe they really were Jews. It was hearing them speak Hebrew that convinced me. Until then, I thought that all Jews were soldiers. That grandfather was an open-minded man. He taught me tolerance towards other peoples. Before I was born, he had invited my father on a vacation to Israel. He bore no hatred whatsoever and found it normal that his son should learn Hebrew. He talked about his Israeli boss with great respect and appreciated his own work in charge of the hotel staff. He showed me photographs taken in Tel Aviv of himself and my grandmother in a beautiful dress with her bracelets, hair blowing in the wind. Some of his children had joined Hamas, but not him. He lived between the soldiers who attacked his house on one side and his boss, whom he liked very much, on the other. He would come back from Israel with cakes that tasted different, with a whole pile of delicious things, and he would give me a half shekel as pocket money. That was a lot.
A Rebel in Gaza, A Daughter of Rafah Speaks, by Asma Al Ghul, is read by Dina Elshinawi and runs for 5 hours and 35 minutes.
The Good Liar by Denise Mina was donated by Penguin Random House.
The sweetness of the elderflower cordial and rising scent of Daphne caught the back of Claudia's throat. She felt a little sick. This was her first party since she was widowed. She didn't want to come, but was here to support her new boss at the forensic analysis company, Forsy Limited. Sir Philip Ardmore had been so supportive of her since James died. Attending the opening ceremony of a building project he'd been instrumental in was the least she could do. The warren of glass and concrete was on the edge of Regent's Park, and something of a miracle in the central London conservation area. Planning regulations had been circumvented somehow or other. She thought the sheer social heft of the board might have something to do with that. Tonight was the opening party, and they were all there. All the MPs and MBEs, the landed and the lords. She would have been anxious about the company if she wasn't still a little numb. The lingering shock of James's sudden death lent her an air of disinterested sang-froid.
A year ago, a father and his fiancée were brutally stabbed in their opulent London townhouse, sparking the most high-profile murder investigation in recent history. Blood spatter expert Dr. Claudia O'Shiel's evidence put the killer behind bars, or so everyone believes. Since the trial, Claudia has learned a horrific truth. Her evidence and her testimony were wrong, and someone she knows made sure of it. Now, as she takes the stage to give a career-defining speech before London's elite, Claudia faces a devastating choice: protect her children and her livelihood with her continued complicity, or blow the whole conspiracy apart and reveal the truth. Not only is the real murderer still out there, they're in the audience. As Claudia steps towards the microphone, she revisits that fateful night. What really happened, and what speech will Claudia give?
Her doctor refused to prescribe antidepressants. "They won't work for you," he said. "Grief is a rational reaction to your husband dying. The depression is natural, not something that can be washed away with chemical sunshine. You'll just have to wait until the gnawing awareness of the frailty of life recedes, which it will. I'm sorry." Claudia was sorry too, but functioning in low mood gave her a new perspective. It wasn't insight so much as a world drained of colour, stripped back to clean lines with all the dissembling and the distractions beyond her grasp. It had been 4 months and 1 week ago, and Claudia had been absolutely still, watching the world move around her. Her face still moved in expression-making ways. Her body went to work, came home, cooked, attended meetings with pastoral care teachers concerned about her boys. But Claudia was frozen, watchful, waiting for the black to lift, to thin, for the shock to lessen. Adrenaline trilled through her body every waking moment. She felt as if she'd woken up at the top of Nelson's Column and was expected to act as if nothing had changed. All she wanted to do was sit and smoke and sob, but she didn't. She couldn't afford to. Ironically, she had been steeply promoted during this time, achieving an income she'd never managed when James was alive. She wondered if her detachment looked like wisdom from the outside, if it was a precondition of her success, and why Sir Philip supported her rapid advancement in an area she had so little experience in. She was coping, she kept reminding herself, countering the voice in her head that insisted she couldn't cope. "You are coping. Look at the evidence."
The Good Liar by Denise Mina is read by Lois Chimimba and runs for 10 hours and 13 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Paula Hawkins worked as a journalist for 15 years before turning her hand to fiction. Her first thriller under her own name, The Girl on the Train, has been a global phenomenon, selling 23 million copies worldwide and published in over 40 languages. It was the number one bestseller around the world and was a number one box office hit film starring Emily Blunt. Paula was at the Wigtown Book Festival with her third novel, A Slow Fire Burning, which is read by Rosamund Pike.
Her shower offered a choice of very hot or very cold, nothing in between. She ran the tips of her wrinkled fingers back and forth over her bone-white, beautiful scars, hip, thigh, shoulder, back of skull. "Here I am," she said quietly to herself. "Here I am."
It's a novel about revenge. It opens with a young man's body is found on a houseboat on the Regent's Canal. He's been brutally murdered, and there are three women who are connected to him, very intriguing characters who may or may not be involved in the killing.
Afterwards, her forearm wrapped ineffectually in reams of toilet paper, the rest of her wrapped in a threadbare towel, sitting on the ugly grey pleather sofa in her living room, Laura rang her mother. It went to voicemail, and she hung up. No point wasting credit. She rang her father next.
You all right, chicken? She could hear noises in the background. The radio. Five Live. Dad! She felt a lump rise to her throat, and she swallowed it. What's up? Dad, could you come round? I had a bad night. I was wondering if you could just come over for a bit. I know it's a bit of a drive, but I... No, Philip. Deirdre in the background, hissing through clenched teeth. We've got Bridge. Dad, could you take me off speaker? Sweetheart, I... Seriously, could you take me off speaker? I don't want to hear her voice. It makes me want to set fire to things. Now, come on, Laura. Just forget it, Dad. It doesn't matter.
Now, what came first? Was it the plot or the character?
My novels always start with character. So I started with one particular character, Laura, who's a young woman who's had a very difficult start in her life. She had an accident as a child and she sort of struggles with various issues, loss of temper, she has no filter, she says inappropriate things. It's difficult for her to navigate the world. So I started with this character. She's, as I say, she's problematic, but she's also vulnerable and I think she's quite appealing too. So I started with her, and then I also had a location, which was the Regent's Canal in London, and the houseboats there, which provided me with some inspiration, and that setting and the character were the starting points for the book.
On her way to the bedroom, she stepped on her jacket, which she dropped in the hallway in her rush to get to the bathroom. She bent down and picked it up. The sleeve was torn. Daniel's watch still in the pocket. She took the watch out, turned it over, slipped it onto her wrist. The toilet paper around her forearm bloomed scarlet, her limb throbbing gently as the blood pulsed out of her. Her head swam.
Rosamund Pike does the audio version of this book. Did you have any choice in narrator?
I was given a list, and I wasn't the person who drew up the list, but I was ecstatic when Rosamund said yes. I think she was pretty much top of that list. You know, I knew she has an extraordinary range. I've seen her do sort of anything from Austin to Gone Girl, where she plays a psychopath. So she's perfect in a way for this book because of that range. And you've got these basically five very different characters that she's got to inhabit, which she does wonderfully. So, yeah, I was absolutely thrilled that she agreed to do it.
Now, one thing we don't get if we download the book from the RNIB Talking Books Library is the cover. Tell us a little bit about that.
Ah, yes. So the cover is, we've got a slow fire burning and we've got some, what looks like smoke, but in that smoke you can see a number of faces. And what's really interesting about that is not everybody seems to sees the same face first. So, and that fits very well with the novel, which you will understand when you've read it, that sort of different faces emerge from the smoke and different people come to prominence at different times.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do. I love the experience of listening to audiobooks. It really takes you back to childhood, that thing of having somebody tell you a story. And, you know, when it's a well-read one, it's just an absolutely, a transporting experience. I do love an audiobook.
Using a pair of scissors to scrape beneath her fingernails, she watched the water running rosy at her feet. She closed her eyes. She listened to Daniel's voice asking, "What is wrong with you?" And Deirdre's voice saying, "No, Philip, we've got Bridge." And to her own, "Set fire to things. Set fire, set fire, set fire, set fire."
A Slow Fire Burning is available in audio commercially now and on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library, where you can also find Paula's second book, Into the Water, and of course, The Girl on the Train.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Escape into the world of great literature with Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, hear from a complete unabridged classic from the RNIB library, beautifully narrated and specially selected for blind and partially sighted listeners. From timeless adventures to literary masterpieces, these serialised audiobooks let you enjoy a new chapter every day. And for younger listeners, don't miss Children's Talking Books every Saturday at 9 a.m. Perfect for the young at heart, and for sparking imaginations.
Talking Books, every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. only on RNIB Connect Radio. Every episode of our current Talking Book and Junior Talking Book is available at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio. From there, you'll find a page that says Books and Accessible Reading, and all shows, Talking Books, Junior Talking Books, and Read On are available right there. Now, let's find some fallen idols. History is not erased when the statues are pulled down. If anything, it is made. Like all of the best historians, Alex von Tunzelmann uses the past to explain what the hell is going on today. In 2020, statues across the world were pulled down in an extraordinary wave of global iconoclasm. From the United States and the United Kingdom to the rest of the world, Black Lives Matter protests defaced and hauled down statues of slaveholders, Confederates and imperialists. Edward Colston was hurled into the harbour in Bristol. Robert E. Lee was covered in graffiti. Christopher Columbus was toppled in Minnesota, beheaded in Massachusetts and thrown into a lake in Virginia. Fallen Idols looks at 12 statues in modern history. It looks at why they were put up, the stories they were supposed to tell, and why those stories were challenged, and how they came down. The audio version of Fallen Idols by Alex von Tunzelmann is read by Kristen Atherton.
Trump visited Mount Rushmore, where, according to South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, he told her it was his dream to have his own face carved into the mountain alongside Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, and Lincoln. "I started laughing," she said. He wasn't laughing, so he was totally serious. Trump responded on Twitter by denying that he had suggested it, then, in the same sentence, suggesting it again. "This is fake news by the failing at New York Times and bad ratings at CNN. Never suggested it, although, based on all of the many things accomplished during the first 3.5 years, perhaps more than any other presidency, sounds like a good idea to me." Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, also took to Twitter. "Those statues teach us about our past, with all its faults. To tear them down would be to lie about our history and impoverish the education of generations to come." The Conservative government announced that it would amend the Criminal Damage Act so anyone damaging a war memorial in Britain could also be looking at 10 years in prison.
So the book is called Fallen Idols, 12 Statues That Made History, and it really looks at the history of putting up and pulling down statues all the way from the American Revolution, where a great statue of George III was pulled down by American revolutionaries straight after Washington read out the Declaration of Independence, all the way through to the sort of Black Lives Matter movement, where indeed a statue of George Washington was pulled down by protesters in Portland, Oregon. So we go through a couple of 100 years of history looking at these movements to represent history through statues or challenge that.
What was the statue that was the catalyst for the book?
It was really the Colston statue, the Edward Colston statue in Bristol that was pulled down. A lot of people will remember kind of during the pandemic that was pulled down and thrown into Bristol Harbour. And I'd been thinking about statues and writing about them for much longer than that. I'd written about the Cecil Rhodes statue in 2016 when that was challenged in Oxford. But that really was a moment when Colston came down when I thought we need to have a better discussion about this. Mm. And that's what prompted the writing of the book.
And you've got 12 in the book. What one's your favourite?
Oh, well, that's a really hard choice. I mean, there are so many that are so, you know, so different. I do think the stories of Lenin and Stalin are so striking. They're very different takes on statues. They're very, very different. And I'm also fascinated by some of the weirder stories, such as Saddam Hussein's statue. You know, the mystery of really, was that pulled down by Iraqis or by American troops, and what sort of happened around that. And then sort of some of the more obscure stories about, for instance, Rafael Trujillo, the dictator of the Dominican Republic, who built lots of statues to himself with, shall we say, a rather phallic implication to them. A very, very unusual story. So there's a real range, I hope, in the book, something for everyone.
In the United States and Britain, right-wing Republican and conservative administrations took this as an opportunity to stoke a culture war. They positioned themselves as the champions of American and British civilization, the last defense against barbarism and political correctness, or, as it was increasingly called, wokeness. In September 2020, the British Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, wrote to museums threatening them with funding cuts if they took any actions motivated by activism or politics. President Trump went further. As I said at Mount Rushmore, which they would love to rip down and rip it down fast, and that's never going to happen, 2 months ago, the left-wing Cultural Revolution is designed to overthrow the American Revolution. He announced the foundation of a 1776 commission intended to promote patriotic education. He also pledged to create a new statue park, the National Garden of American Heroes.
The audiobook's narrated by Kristen Atherton. What did you think of that?
Oh, she was wonderful. I remember they play you clips of a voice and they sent me a voice of Kristen's voice sample and I said, she sounds like what I wish I spoke like. So she's done a fantastic job.
Do you not fancy doing it yourself?
Oh, I mean, I do think, you know, I have to say, I think most authors do not read their own books brilliantly. I think a proper voice actor does that job properly, and I should let the grown-ups do that thing.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I'm a huge audiobook fan, yes, but that's one of the reasons why I don't read my own. I'm very picky about who reads them. I think it makes a big difference. So some of my favourites, actually, I think are incredibly well-read. Unfortunately, Hilary Mantel, of course, recently died, but the audiobook of Beyond Black is fantastically well-read. Really recommend that to any listeners. And also really enjoyed the audiobook of George Saunders' Lincoln in the Bardo, which is read by a huge cast and just absolutely wonderfully done.
Can statues really be this big a deal? Most of us who live in towns or cities probably walk past these lumps of stone and metal every day without thinking much, or at all, about who they are or what they mean. We may, of course, enjoy some of the more amusing ones, such as the hippopotamus statues that appear to be swimming half-submerged in the pavement in Taipei, Taiwan. When it comes to the standard-issue statue of an old gentleman on a horse, though, you can ask 20 passers-by who he is, and chances are none of them will get it right. As the Austrian writer Robert Musil observed, "There is nothing in this world as invisible as a monument."
Fallen Idols is available in audio commercially. From RNIB, you can get Alex's books, Blood and Sand, Suez Hungary and the Crisis that Shook the World, and Indian Summer, The Secret History of the End of an Empire. And to finish our listen back to some of our Wigtown hidden gems, let's get The Books of My Life from Stuart Kelly. Stuart Kelly is a Scottish critic and author. He is the literary editor of The Scotsman, and his works include The Book of Lost Books, An Incomplete History of All the Great Books You'll Never Read, an account of books destroyed, misplaced, never finished, or never even began, from ancient Greek and Arabic masters through Shakespeare, Dante, Hemingway, right up to the present day. So before I asked him for the books of his life, I asked him for the lost book of his life.
That's quite a difficult question about which lost book I would want back. I suppose there's some obvious choices. Homer did a comedy epic called The Margites, which it would be astonishing to see what Homer's comedy was like. Mm. I don't know if it would pass all the politically correct takes nowadays. Of course, there's Shakespeare, but Cardenio is quite a late play. And the late plays, you know, after The Tempest, if you're looking at The Two Noble Kinsmen or some of the later ones there, they're not the vintage work. So there's also, by Shakespeare, there's Love's Labour's One, which we don't know anything about. In fact, it might be one of the other plays. So, you know, obviously you'd want Shakespeare and you'd want Homer. But I don't know. I think, in a way, I prefer the books that are lost because they're always going to be perfect. And the last thing you want is to get something like, let's say, Sylvia Plath's second novel, Double Exposure, and realise that it just wasn't all that good.
So, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I think I've always been in love with reading, but there was a series of Ladybird books, which were in rhyming quatrains, that apparently I was obsessed with. And I would demand having First Day of the Holidays or Squirrel Nutkin's Adventure again and again and again. But the most important thing for me in some ways was it told you all the other books. It's a bit like the Mr. Men books, that you could see on the back of them all the other ones. And I think that's what induced my bibliomania, thinking, I have to have all of these.
This is a tale about a tale. A tale that belonged to a little red squirrel, and his name was Nutkin. He had a brother called Twinkleberry, and a great many cousins. They lived in a wood at the edge of a lake. In the middle of the lake, there is an island covered with trees and nut bushes, and amongst those trees stands a hollow oak tree, which is the house of an owl who is called Old Brown. One autumn, when the nuts were ripe and the leaves on the hazel bushes were golden and green, Nutkin and Twinkleberry and all the other little squirrels came out of the wood and down to the edge of the lake. They made little rafts out of twigs, and they paddled away over the water to Owl Island to gather nuts. Each squirrel had a little sack and a large oar, and spread out his tail for a sail.
The Adventure of Squirrel Nutkin is available from RNIB Talking Books in The Complete Beatrix Potter, narrated by Diana Bishop. And there are many Ladybird First Favourite Tales available from RNIB.
And is there a book that you go back to again and again on a rainy day?
I go back to the work of G.K. Chesterton quite frequently. I think he was one of the most beautiful essayists that we had. I know that some people have got some concerns about his politics now, but this was the man that said there are two enemies to humanity, Hitler and the Emperor of Japan. And the fact that he was such a wit, such a wag, and was just generally so funny. And something like The Man Who Was Thursday is, I can go back to every time, I still don't understand that book.
The suburb of Saffron Park lay on the sunset side of London, as red and ragged as a cloud of sunset. It was built of a bright brick throughout. Its skyline was fantastic, and even its ground plan was wild. It had been the outburst of a speculative builder, faintly tinged with art, who called its architecture sometimes Elizabethan and sometimes Queen Anne, apparently under the impression that the two sovereigns were identical. It was described with some justice as an artistic colony, though it never in any definable way produced any art. But although its pretensions to be an intellectual centre were a little vague, its pretensions to be a pleasant place were quite indisputable. The stranger who looked for the first time at the quaint red houses could only think how very oddly shaped the people must be who could fit into them. Nor, when he met the people, was he disappointed in this respect. The place was not only pleasant, but perfect. As if once he could regard it not as a deception, but rather as a dream.
The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, as narrated by Toby Longworth. It's one of many Chesterton books available from RNIB, along with three different biographies. And something you've read recently that you'd like to recommend.
There's a book by a chap called Dennis Duncan called Index, A History of the. And you might think it sounds like the most boring topic in the world, but the whole way in which he shows how there are aspects of books which we are so accustomed to, we no longer actually look at. So when was the first page number on a book? How do we sort the information in a book? It's a really great work in terms of the human side of reading. I mean, all of us sometimes will use the index rather than the book. You know, we'll be looking for a particular thing that we want to know about. And it has the funniest index I've ever read in a book. He's done an exceptional job, and his indexer has done an exceptional job. So, you know, Index, A History of the... I even love the title to pieces.
It is hard to imagine working with books, writing an essay, a lecture, a report, a sermon, without the ability to find what you're looking for quickly and easily, without, that is, the convenience of a good index. This convenience, of course, is not confined to people who write for a living. It spills over into other disciplines, into everyday life, and some of the earliest indexes appear in legal statutes, medical texts, recipe books. The humble back-of-book index is one of those inventions that are so successful, so integrated into our daily practices, that they can often become invisible. But like any piece of technology, the index has its history, one that, for nearly 800 years, was intimately entwined with a particular form of the book, the codex. The sheaf of pages, folded and bound together at the spine. Now, however, it has entered the digital era as the key technology underpinning our online reading. The very first web page, after all, was a subject index. As for the search engine, the port of embarkation for so much of our internet navigation, Google engineer Matt Cutts explains that the first thing to understand is that when you do a Google search, you aren't actually searching the web, you're searching Google's index of the web. Today, the index organizes our lives, and this book will chart its curious path from the monasteries and universities of Europe in the 13th century to the glass and steel HQs of Silicon Valley in the 21st.
Index, A History of the, by Dennis Duncan, is available in audio commercially, as narrated by Neil Gardner. And Stuart Kelly, thank you so much. That's all we've got time for on this episode of Read On. The Wigtown Book Festival starts on the 26th of September and runs until the 5th of October. And if you see a man with a big white beard and a microphone that says RNIB Connect Radio, come and say hello. Otherwise, I'll be back at the same time next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.